I'm a grateful alcoholic. My name is George. Seventh tradition. First of all, I thank the group for its patience while I was not here for the last couple of weeks. But I had a lot of experience with the seventh tradition while I was gone, and I'm going to get to that somehow or other tonight. I don't know how that's going to come out, but I want to review tradition six first, because that's what we've been doing, and I'm going to read the sixth tradition. I'm going to start off with the long form, go over a little review, do some of the questions out of the checklist, and then I'm going to move right into seven, and I'm going to do the short form of seven this week, because if I do the long form of seven, you'll really understand why we have it. It's really, really key to what the seventh tradition is about, and I'm going to talk about the problems we had in the seventh tradition, a lot of them. Tradition six in the long form, problems of money, property, and authority may easily divert us from our primary spiritual aim. We think, therefore, that any considerable property of genuine use to AA should be separately incorporated and managed, thus dividing the material from the spiritual. An AA group as such should never go into business, secondary aids to AA, such as clubs or hospitals, which require much property or administration, or to be incorporated and set apart that, if necessary, they can freely be discarded by the groups. Hence such facilities, or to not use the AA name. Their management should be the sole responsibility of those people who financially support them. For clubs, AA managers are usually preferred, but hospitals as well as other places of recuperation ought to do well outside of AA. The medicals are and medically supervised, while an AA group may cooperate with anyone. Such cooperation ought never go as far as affiliation or endorsement, actual or implied. An AA group can not bind itself to anyone. That sixth tradition is very important because we're going to move right into the seventh tradition in a couple of minutes. And when we do, we're going to see we're going to be talking again about money. And the sixth tradition starts with the money. And this is probably one of the toughest traditions when it came to money. But in the review of the sixth tradition, I love the my little coloring book, I like to call it, the Traditions Illustrated. There's a three-paragraph little story that tells you really what the sixth tradition is all about. The related facility may be an outside group combating alcoholism, or it may be an enterprise that AAs themselves want to start. It was the latter that most of us often confronted the young fellowship. Outside agencies were pretty scarce in those days, and some members thought that AA should cover the whole alcoholism field. Led by the super promoter, which is the story in the 12 and 12. It talks about the hospital that on different floors they're going to have different things, and drying out place and treatment, and picture any group as a group of us trying to run something like that. Who would be the chief to run it? Who the arguments that would go on? And if you want to get any idea of what those are like, just go to any business meeting and you'll see people arguing and fighting over things within AA. Can you imagine if we had to get some profit out of it, what we would be doing to each other? So, you know, I always look at that. Though the ambitious center did fail, some individual members have since founded successful clubhouses, rest farms, halfway houses, etc. These enterprises are run by those in AA and are patronized by other members or prospective members. But where money and property is involved, we try to stay out of that controversy completely. We have another tradition, I'll get involved with that later on. Therefore, it was proved wise that to keep the operation of the facility completely separate from any AA group, and to keep the terms of the names. And there are groups today that I don't even want to mention the names of the group that used stuff that comes right out of our 12 steps or 12 traditions. They named themselves after that. And AA said that we shouldn't do that because we're implying an affiliation. So there are certain halfway houses that have names today that actually are implied affiliation, even though we know they're not. And it gives AA a bad name when somebody in that facility or something happens where somebody runs off and there's a newspaper article. And we get, you know, AA gets a black eye, not the facility or the people that ran it. So we have to be careful of those things. Toward outside agencies dealing with alcoholism, the policy is cooperation, but not affiliation. AA cooperates, for example, by welcome referrals from any of these institutions. We also cooperate by going into institutions such as jails where we bring a meeting in. We cooperate. We're not affiliated with any of the jails we go to, as such as AA. The group sends members who want to carry that message to that sick and suffering alcoholic, which is going back to the third and the fifth tradition, which really is the first tradition. And I can bounce these traditions all around, and I'll still come up with what is our primary purpose, and it's to help the sick and suffering alcoholic. And no tradition was harder pounded out on that than tradition seven. They talk about the in the little drawings, it found that there are all kinds of good motives and good goals that are out there. But as AA members, we do not will cooperate with them. As individuals, we can be involved with them, but not with AA's name itself, because AA is not affiliated with them. There are members that, for example, that work in the industry of treatment, and they work for a company. They are not an AA counselor, for example. That's one of my favorite ones. All they are is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who works in a treatment center, and when they're in that treatment center, they're a counselor. They're not an AA member. And then when they come here at night, they're not an authoritarian on counseling in AA. All they are is a member. So, you know, you wear two hats, but you got to know when to wear which hat. Because if we wear the wrong hat, what ends up happening is we're either affiliating and we're either hurting the facility that they work at, or they're hurting AA as a whole. So that is one of those dilemmas of that sixth tradition, which is going to lead us into the seventh tradition. The other thing that they talk about, there are two major danger areas in tradition six. Our course has been charted and the hazards are clearly marked. We steer clear of them. We should have, if we steer clear of them, we'll have smooth sailing. Affiliation of a great AA group with anything outside of AA, whether it be a hospital, an institution, somebody starting up who wants to open a bookstore and sell a conference and non-conference literature and all kinds of recovery stuff, and we can cooperate them as a group, but we have to be careful not to affiliate with them, because that's not AA. It's a store that's selling stuff, not our stuff sometimes. And if somebody walks in and they see something that's not Alcoholics Anonymous from another fellowship, they may think we're cooperating or we're affiliated with such other groups, and we're not. And the other thing is that any activity that would harm AA as a whole, and I told this story before I got sick of the group that I came out of out in West Broward, where there was two meetings at 10 o'clock at night, and two 10 o'clock meetings. One was from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other one was from Narcotics Anonymous. And the two of them decided to have a dance. And on the piece of literature, we were really actually trying to cooperate with each other, so not to interfere with anybody. It was on a Saturday night. And when they wrote the piece of paper, they had the AA symbol on one side and the NA symbol on another. That looked like it was one fellow, that we were becoming one fellowship. And that is not the case. They're two separate fellowships with two singlenesses of purpose that are separate from each other. Maybe similar, but they're separate. So, you know, we have to be careful. So what ended up happening is the West Broward Club itself had a dance, and both groups decided to cooperate. No affiliation of fellowships. So that was a hard thing, and that's how a lot of the other fellowships got started. So that pretty much takes us to the questions that are asked in the checklist in Tradition 6. And Tradition 6 reads, in the short form, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Least problems of money, property, and prestige will divert us from our primary purpose, and that is to carry the message, which is always what our purpose is going to be. Should my fellow group members and I go out and raise money or to endorse several AA beds in local hospitals? One of my favorite things that I always hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, the AA picnic. There is no such thing as an AA picnic. To discourage those people who think they're going to an AA picnic, they're going to a picnic that's put on by a group that is supported by AA members. So there's no such thing as an AA event. Conventions are very touchy. I hear a lot of people, why do I have to pay to go to a convention? It's a meeting and I can't afford to go. Well, we have to pay, or the convention committee has to pay to get a speaker there. They got to fly them in. And it's an AA function, but it's not an affiliation. Even though we have a state one and we have the national one, which just passed, what they do is they're raising money to pay for the people that come in to speak. They have groups that somebody just spoke not too long ago, one of the speakers, and a lot of people were saying, well, why do I have to go hear a speaker if I'm an AA member? Well, you go to a regular meeting if you want that, but if somebody's coming in who speaks that way and he's not getting paid for his service of speaking, what he's getting paid is to be flown in from whatever state he comes to, and a hotel room that group is providing for him so he can speak. So there's a lot of people that get in that and they think that's AA. It's not. It's a cooperation that AA has with those people. So there's, you know, the only thing we'll ever be in Alcoholics Anonymous is a member. Any one of us. We'll never get higher than that. If we're lucky enough, some of us get to be servants, I always say. Do we go out and solicit for these things? No, we're not supposed to. And, you know, many times I'll go into an AA meeting and hear them soliciting for someone for tickets for something. It doesn't matter what the ticket's for, whether it's, we do. It's not appropriate to do it as an AA thing. One of my favorites, and it's one of the good causes that we cooperate with, is Bowling for Big Books. Now, it sounds like it's a great thing and it's an AA thing, but it's really not. It's a group putting money together to help the institution committee pay for big books for people in institutions or in hospitals. It is, we cooperate with that, but we're not affiliated with that. And sometimes when you hear those kind of announcements in a meeting, you think that that's AA. It's not. It's something we do as individuals. This group passes two baskets, and I use that one all the time. One is to pay for coffee in an institution, and the other is for the group Seventh Tradition. Two separate baskets, and they are separate, and one is a different color, and it is done to cooperate for those people who can get that stuff, and they can bring it into them, while the group money is held separately. That's a whole lot of issues that brings up a lot of controversy in a lot of meetings and a lot of business meetings. All right, is it good for a group to lease a small building? Now, these questions you can figure out. There's a great pamphlet. You can order it from Intergroup, and it talks about problems with money. Are the officers and members of a local club of AA familiar with the guidelines on clubs? And that's the pamphlet that's available from the GSO. Should the secretary or group serve on the mayor's advisory committee on alcoholism? And we had a member that did that in Alcoholics Anonymous by the name of Marty Mann. She helped create that, and it created a lot of controversy for Bill and Bob. We talked about that before I went out of here about a month ago. Some alcoholics will stay around AA only if they have a TV and a card room. Is this what is required to carry the message to them? Should we have these facilities? I'm not even going to get into that controversy. But those are some of the questions that will be asked in the checklist of in the traditions checklist. Now we're moving into the seventh tradition. Like I said, this is probably the toughest tradition. I'm going to quote what Bill wrote right in the 12 and 12. He said, probably no AA tradition had the labor pains this one did. Now, this is in the 12 and 12. If you look at the history, and there's two articles we always see. One of the articles is in the traditions, how it developed, and that one was written in 1946, and it talks about, and the name of the article was What Led Up to the Writing of Tradition 7, and that was in 1946. And in 1948, in the 12 and 12 was Tradition 7 itself, and then in 1950, I don't want to call it the wrong year, 57 was Respecting Money. So there were three issues pertaining to money, because money for alcoholics was dangerous, very dangerous, especially in our active times. There are three problems that is addressed, and they are addressed in AA Comes of Age. Had it somewhere. And the three problems they discuss, and I'm going to read the three problems, and I'm going to talk about some things that happened in the seventh tradition that led us here. Before I do that, the guidelines for the seventh tradition, and in AA Comes of Age, it's probably one of the best readings. Where Bill got the ideas and where the formation of this came about is actually from St. Francis, believe it or not. And here's what he wrote, and it's in page 111 when he talks about the legacy. A big factor in our thinking at the time was the philosophy of St. Francis of Assisi. in our thinking, his also began the lay movement, one man carrying the good news to the next. In his day, it was common enough for individuals to pledge themselves to poverty, but it was unusual, if not unique, for a whole organization or fellowship to do the same thing. For the purpose of his society, Francis saw corporate poverty to be fundamental. The less money and property they had to quarrel about, the less there would be in the division from their primary purpose. And just like today, AA today, this outfit did not need much money to accomplish its mission. Why be tempted and diverted when there was no need for it? Therefore, AA adopted the wisdom of St. Francis as its own. Not only would we have the least possible service organization, we would have the least possible money. For this does not mean that no money at all, but it does mean the least possible money to do the job well. It is in this sense that AA has declared the principle of corporate poverty its chief safeguard for the future. Now, that was where the idea came from. In 1937, Bill got hooked up with Rockefeller, and then 3 years later, Rockefeller threw a dinner in 1940, and I'm going to tell that story a little later. And what ended up happening from that is Bill gives special thanks for these two principles, because that's really what gave us our seventh tradition, because Rockefeller got up at the end of the dinner because Bill was seeing all these wealthy bankers, and what he said is, boy, you know, the money was going off in his head. And I'm going to really read the story because it's a great story for us to carry. And what ended up happening is Rockefeller's son, Nelson Rockefeller Jr., got up and says, we don't want to screw this up with money. And that was the second, we did not know that was going to be the bedrock that helped between St. Francis and the Rockefellers, that we decided to take this course of the least possible money. The first came when we met Rockefeller Jr. in 37. At the time, the possibility of unlimited financial backing dimmed our sharing of the vision of St. Francis. Dr. Bob and I, indeed, as most of us, were awfully broke. Ideas of comfortable, well-paid jobs, chains of hospitals, and tons of free literature for the suffering alky seized our imagination. But Rockefeller, and what he did is he bought he gave us $1,000 and suggested that anybody who was at this particular dinner offer the list, because we were looking at it and we were thinking in terms of millions, knowing how Bill was thinking already. He was already building a new empire in his mind. And Bob was saying, slow down, you know, that was the fight that would go on between them. And what ended up happening was that they did that, and what they did is, to anybody that was invited to this dinner, they sent a copy of the Big Book. Now, we are such good alcoholics, even back then, that the book was $3 and change a book, and what ended up happening was we gave Rockefeller a special break and only charged him $1 a book, because we were hungry for money. And that was one of the things, we were that broke. And there's the story of Bert Taylor, who lost his business, and there's lots of rich history that goes on that started the foundation of this seventh tradition. And what ended up happening is Rockefeller had other ideas. He said, I think money will spoil this. He acted accordingly, and AA stayed poor. St. Francis had given us the idea, but Rockefeller wisely forced us to live up to it. This was an oddly assorted pair who were really responsible for AA's tradition on money. Thank God for both of them. What it says in our literature. That was the first hurdle we hit with the seventh tradition. The second temptation was veered in the other extreme. We shared money that we with tightwad, half refusing to support AA's simple but essential area groups. Now, the story that comes out of that particular one is we were trying to get $1 a member. It was like $2.50 a year, and if you read the literature and it goes over it, they wanted it would cost approximately the group place, maybe coffee. It was $5 annually a member they were figuring for the group, and a drop maybe $25 a year in the hat. If he belongs to a club, it may be $50, and in the case of he takes care of the great volume, these ones, another $2.50 a year. And they were asking the groups, the individual members, to send $1 a year per member. And that wasn't happening. Well, Bill got a little upset. There's a couple of different stories. One tells a story where Bill threw a phone out a window. Another says that a drunk came by his office and stuck his head in, which is the one that we all got in our literature. And when that drunk came in, Bill took $5 out of his pocket and gave it to this drunk, and he thought it was a great idea at the time. And I'm going to tell that story a little later. And that was the second problem we had with money, was we went spending it the other way because we were tightwad, and they felt that the earning power of most of our members was better than average. So even now it hadn't quite surmounted. We still drag our heels when the hat is passed to support our local intergroup office and general headquarters. And this holding back is not for lack of funding money either. The collective income of AA's membership, the sum of our wages, salaries, and our involvements, we are presently such a total of about $1 billion a year. And we're talking about in the early 50s and the late 40s. This is what we figured that the earning capacity of the members at the time was. Our earning power as individuals may actually be double the average. The material payoff, as well as the spiritual payoff of AA's way of life, is downright incredible. Nevertheless, we still balk at the bit when it comes to paying AA's very reasonable service bill. Sometimes I think it may be all too good. Think about meetings that have donuts and the arguments that go over what kind of donuts to buy. Buy the 99-cent ones or go buy out a $10 cake every week. Those are arguments that go on in AA constantly. But, you know, the group comes to its own conscience on that. And then it talks about a lot of the other things about the 23rd Street Clubhouse. And there's a story of Bill that night after he gave this guy the $5, that the group got up, and they don't usually solicit money, or they didn't, and it wasn't very much folding money going into the hat at the time, that Bill had a 50-cent piece, and he had a 10-cent piece, and he put a dime in, and it kind of, the small change, and he kept the 50-cent piece because they thought it was too large, but he remembered the grandiosity of that morning when somebody needed money, and he realized where spirituality and money mixed. And we're going to talk about a couple of those instances in AA. And the third problem is the temptation, the greatest peril of all three. The Trustees Foundation came up with it. There was members themselves, there was an Alcoholics Anonymous, a trust in trust for the foundation, the sum of $10,000. Somebody left $10,000 to us, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we didn't know what to do with it. And there was a big debate over it. The foundation was really hard up at them. The groups were not sending in enough money to support the office. We had been tossing it in all the book income to help pay for the foundation at the time. Then Bill and Bob were still poor. We were still paying them $30 a week out of the $5,000 Rockefeller had given to us that went to the Riverside Church, which was doling it out, and we actually paid that back. With one of the only people that, I think we are the only group of people that ever paid back the Rockefeller Foundation a gift that was given to us to help start Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's one of those little bits of history that we didn't want to take anybody's money from the outside. And then we were having the problem internally. What do you do with the $10,000 donation? There's lots of members in here who want to leave property and stuff. And it left a problem for the foundation. And the foundation, some said the groups will never fully support the office. We can't let it shut down. We're too vital. Yes, let's take the money. Let's take all such donations in the future. We're going to need them. Then came the opposition within the foundation. Out of the foundation board already, we knew the total of $500,000 was set aside for AAs and wills that were still alive. Heaven only knows how much we had not heard about, for outside donations were not declined, not absolutely cut off. The foundation would one day become rich. Moreover, the slightest information of the general public from our trustees would be that we need money. We could become immensely rich. Compared to the prospect of $10,000 under the condition, what were we going to do? And we ended up setting a rule of $2,000 and no more. Now, what does this all have to do with us as individuals, the seventh tradition? Well, I told the Rockefeller story about Bill and Bob, and there's lots of wonderful stories throughout our literature. But there's actually three stories that I want to talk about. The first one is, let's begin with Bill Sponsor. Ebby, where is the money in the spirituality mix? Ebby had to take the train from New York to Brooklyn. It cost him some money. And he talks about that. And it was his resolve to sit down, and whether he, you know, they bought lunch or they sat at the table, it cost him some money, but a very little bit of money, but a lot of time. And that's really where we mixed. And that was the first real thing of where we saw the spirituality and finances mix. The next day, he had to look at one of those meetings that were held in the summer in Akron. That was the gathering in Dr. Bob's house, in his living room, where Ann made ready for them. There was shelter over their heads. There was food. There was expenses for coffee. And Dr. Bob paid for it. If Ann and Dr. Bob had not given these hospital services, no meeting could have been held. So that was in Dr. Bob's house. And then as the active meeting got larger, they moved the house to T. Henry and Clarence Williams. They purchased a lot of extra chairs, served many suppers. Their home stood much wear and tear, as well as their house. The alcoholics did not pay a cent. T. Henry and Clarence sacrificed a great amount of time and some money. If they had not done so, there would have not been no meeting there either as they grew. Then comes the part of AA, is us in regular meetings, as it was in the 23rd Street Clubhouse when Bill had the problem, when the group was going under because they didn't have enough to pay the rent. And it says, as AA grew, homes were no longer big enough for the meetings. We had to have more, moved into hotel parlors and halls. This marked a time when the groups themselves had to begin to pay. Landlords wanted their money, so a collection had to be taken. These collections were voluntary, but great cries went up nevertheless. AA was not supposed to cost anything, they'd said. We cannot mix the great spiritual idea with the landlord's commercialism. But the landlords were not impressed. They had, they said, either pay or get out. Sounds like something they would do. So we did pay. Voluntary contributions became a fact of AA life. We could not function without them. Moreover, somebody had to collect the money. We had to have a bank, which meant we needed a treasurer. The group soon found that they needed a secretary, someone known as a chairman, intergroups, and we grew. And there are small amounts of finances that are needed for this. And all these examples are obvious. You can see that the test of any AA service really is, whether it's a book, the translation of a book, a service conference, a 20th anniversary, a convention, the principle is always the same. And the test is always identical. Do we need this particular service or do we not? That's the only question we have to ask ourselves. Now, how do we carry the message in different ways, the seventh tradition? How are we self-supporting? Well, somebody comes into this group on a regular basis and makes coffee. He's doing a service for the group. Someone else sets up the chairs. Someone cleans the room. Those are services that we don't see all the time. There are meetings where people come in and church basement kind of meetings. We got to get there earlier and set everything up, and you got to get there half hour early, and you got to leave it neater than it was when you got it. There's still a lot of those around. So, you know, those are services that we do as members. Not everybody can afford to put money in the basket. I have a sponsor who for their first 10 years of sobriety could not afford to put money in the basket. They were young when they got in here. They couldn't get employment. For whatever reason, it took them 10 years before they could put a dollar in the basket. Thank God the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are other people who can put a lot of money in the basket. We have to be careful of that grandiosity. We have to stay right size. When I came in here, in the name of the halfway house, which is around the corner, which I won't name, because I am not going to affiliate with it. I will cooperate with them as much as I can. I used to have to walk 3 miles to a room because I was too proud to ask for a ride. And in the name of that halfway house, because nobody would put money in, we would drink their coffee, we would eat their cake and donuts, and nobody put a buck in the basket. My sponsor suggested very strongly that every Wednesday night I go there quietly, got permission from the halfway house to let me stay out past curfew to clean the room. Now we're going to get into the next tradition about special service workers in aid, which also has to do with money, and we're going to be talking about Tom the fireman later on. which is another story we're going to get into. We're being paid for doing things, and I'll talk about things I did as an electrician and with an electrician to do work where I got paid for it because the group needed it. But because I couldn't put money in the basket when I got here, I wanted to be of service, and that was the service I did. Every Wednesday night, me and three or four other people stayed in that room, cleaned up that room, we vacuumed, we cleaned the ashtrays, we washed the coffee cups. In those days, I had coffee cups, and now we get paper cups. We got to clean the toilet bowls, vacuum the floors, and put the chairs in. I never tell anybody I was able to do that. I had to keep my mouth shut about that. So that was one of the things we did. And then I had the opportunity of being self-supporting. And this really has to do about the individual as well as the group. And how did I do this individually? I worked around the corner. There's a shopping center right around the corner. Now it's a sports bar. It used to be a restaurant. And I used to work there. And the only reason I got a job there was because of the owner of the halfway house that knew the guy, and because I was a union official, nobody in Florida really wanted to hire me because they were afraid I was going to organize. And I got a job that I got paid like $12 a day, and like everything but $3, whatever I made between that $12 and $15 that I made at the very beginning of my sobriety, went to the halfway house to pay for my rent. The rest went to a pack of cigarettes at the time, and a couple of packs of ramen noodles for those people who lived on them like I did for the first 9 months. And from there, I was introduced to a job at the Olive Garden, which is no longer there. And because of that job, the guy who got it for me the day I walked in, he was a waiter, and I was going on the interview, and they put me in as to follow somebody, and he split with all the money. And I thought I was going to lose the job, and you know, it wasn't giving him a bad name. It was giving everybody that lived in that halfway house and Alcoholics Anonymous a bad name. And I walked in, and the manager and I became friends, and I kept that job and eventually moved over to Denny's. That was my upgrade for $1.97 an hour I was working at the time, being a busboy. And I had to sign a paper, and eventually I became a waiter. And slowly but surely, that little halfway house that I walked out, which today you can never do, owing him a lot of money. He would never stand for it today. I paid that back. Out of every day that I got some cash, I went over and I paid him back. And I walked out being self-supporting. I lived in a halfway house with someone else by the name of Dennis O. I lived at his halfway house for a while. And while I was at his halfway house, I was going to move out. That was 3 years into sobriety. Went from the fractional house to another, to a people with a year or more in it. And I decided to move out, and I hooked up with this guy who had a year or two. I gave him the $1,500 for the deposit. He disappeared with all my money. I had nowhere to live. And here I am stuck again without money. I mean, I just have a bad picker when it came to the people I trusted with money. And what ended up happening after that, I was blessed with raising my hand at a meeting and telling somebody what happened. Somebody with 13 years rented me a room, actually gave me a room for the first 2 months, and I lived with him for a while. And because of that, I had a wonderful sponsor. The man's name was Bob Welsh, who got very sick, and I spent a lot of time with him, and how we do service is what this is really about. Now, I was doing service for myself. I didn't have a lot of money. I did not have a car. We were joking around the other day. I was talking with Ben T about my early sobriety, riding on a skateboard. I had one of those go boards my first 3 years of sobriety. Never had a DUI, never had a speeding ticket in New York, just had other issues going on with the state and I, which we didn't see eye to eye on. Eventually they won and I cleaned up my wreckage. But there were things that went on, and those were things that my early sobriety bought me. And Bob Welsh got real sick. And when Bob Welsh got real sick, we used to sit in the house all the time and talk, and we talked about him going home, him getting ready to go to pass on. And there's a lot of people that I've been around who passed on sober, and he was one of those guys that showed me about dignity and respect and how to be of service to someone, to be accountable and present for someone, while the end of their life was going. And because of that experience, when my mom got real sick, I was able to be there for her. And that's all the service we talk about. And because of that, I think of a very good friend of mine by the name of Kelly Peck. Kelly Peck was a 38-year-old woman. She had a very young son. She was diagnosed with cervical cancer, and there was six women and George. Monday night, One woman would stay over till Tuesday morning. Tuesday, one of the other women would stay over. Wednesday, right through the end of the week, and Sunday morning to Monday morning, George would come and spend with Kelly. And I spent that time with her because I was given that way of doing service for someone through my sponsor, who let me carry it to my mother, who now I was able to carry it to a friend. And in this year, I've carried it to a lot of other friends who are no longer with us. And it's just a wonderful gift to be able to be with people as they're ready to go home and to be there and be part of that. It's just the way I look at it, and it all started with me being of service first, the person who carried the message to me, and how I was able to carry that to others. At year six of sobriety, I got very sick, and at year six of sobriety, people came and carried the message to me. In the last month and a half, I was very sick. I walked into the room in the hospital on the 5th of July, and at 8 o'clock, and by 8:30, there were six people in front of me from Alcoholics Anonymous. Some came from a hospital. Some others came. Somebody from downstairs heard my name. They knew me from one of the rooms I came into. They came up to say hello to me. Nurses that from 2 years ago when I was sick showed up. It was amazing my first night there, and all these God incidents that took place, and how God kept showing up with people from Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, it's not about the money that we talk about. It's about how the message is carried to us and how the love of the fellowship shows up in times like this. Is money necessary? Yes, but it's not our primary purpose. It's the love of the fellowship, of the people in the fellowship that show up time after time in ways you never expect. If I tell you all the gifts that happened in the last month and a half, people would say, impossible. But it only happens in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, through people like you, in places like this. No matter what's going on, that message of hope and love and that spirit that is given through the people only comes in here. I've never gotten it anywhere else. I believe that today that is God showing his anonymity through other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he does it all the time. You know, the gifts of the people, the spiritual gifts, you can't put a price on. In our literature, and I want to end because this is not usually where I go in the seventh tradition. In our literature, there's a part in the big book that I just want to read because, you know, we talk about what Alcoholics Anonymous is and what it is in so many different ways. It talks about carrying your message to the guy, making your second visit on someone, when you're lucky enough to be doing that. It says that, let him know, it says you tell him your story. If he wishes to make a decision, let him tell his story. But at no time insist upon it if he prefers to consult with someone else. So we got a live and let live kind of thing. It says he may be broken, homeless. If he is, you might try to help him out about getting a job or giving him a little financial assistance, but be sure you do not deprive your family or your creditors of money that he should have. Perhaps you will want to take the man to your home for a few days. Be sure that you use discretion. Be certain you're not trying to he's not trying to impose on you for money, connections, or shelter. Permit this, and you will harm him. If you will be making, or you'll be making it possible for him to be insincere, you may be aiding in his destruction rather than his recovery. Never avoid these responsibilities. Be sure you are doing them for the right thing, and that when you do assume them, helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while is not enough. Have to act the Good Samaritan every day, if need be. It may mean loss of many nights' sleep, great interference with your pleasures, interruptions in your business. It may mean sharing your money or your home, consoling frantic wives and relatives, innumerable trips to police station, courts, asylums, hospital, jails. Your telephone may jingle at any time, day or night. Your wife may sometimes say she's being neglected. A drunk may smash the furniture in your home or burn the mattress. You may have to fight with them. You may have to get them locked up. I've done that already. Sometimes you have to call a doctor to get him the help he needs, or take him to a detox or a hospital. Another time you may have to send for the police or an ambulance. Occasionally you will have to meet these such conditions. I will tell you that since I've been here, I've met most of those conditions. And I will gladly meet them one day at a time, provided God gives me the grace to continue doing that. That, to me, is what the seventh tradition is all about. Thanks for letting me share.